From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. There's no shortage of gore and special effects in David Cronenberg's movies, like Scanners, Videodrome, The Fly, and Dead Ringers. But Cronenberg uses horror films to get at the big life and death questions. On today's Fresh Air, David Cronenberg tells us why he makes horror films. Also today, actress Pamela Reed talks about how playing a nude scene showed her the generous spirit of a fine actor. Reed co-starred in The Long Riders, Melvin and Howard, Tanner 88, and Rachel River. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the science fiction opera Valis, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg celebrates Flag Day by decoding the lyrics to our national anthem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. David Cronenberg makes horror movies about the mind and the body it is trapped in. His 1986 remake of The Fly starred Jeff Goldblum as a scientist who slowly turns into a giant insect as a result of an experiment gone wrong. Scanners is about people who are born telepathic and are driven crazy by the constant noise of other people's thoughts. Parasites are sexually transmitted in his film They Came From Within. Cronenberg's other movies include Videodrome, Rabid, The Brood, and The Dead Zone, which was adapted from a Stephen King novel. David Cronenberg is a Canadian filmmaker who writes most of the movies he directs. He co-wrote and directed his latest film, Dead Ringers, which stars Jeremy Irons and Genevieve Bugeaud. It just came out on home video. In Dead Ringers, Jeremy Irons plays two roles, identical twin gynecologists. The brothers fall in love with the same woman, and they fool her into thinking that she's involved with only one man. The twins' physical and emotional closeness leads to their undoing. In this scene, one of the brothers has become a barbiturate addict. His twin is trying to prevent him from taking more sleeping pills.
I can't sleep. If you're asking me for sleep, I'll tell you right now, you're not going to get one.
But what am I going to do then?
You'll stay up.
I'll die if I don't sleep.
You'll stay up.
What if I take something when you go home?
I'm staying right here.
What if I take something when you go to sleep?
I won't go to sleep.
How do you stay awake?
I'll take something.
You'll take an up so that I don't take a down. This is crazy.
Bev, don't worry about me. I'm not you.
David Cronenberg, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks very much.
In Dead Ringers, what were some of the physical and psychological connections that interested you in the story of twin doctors, of twins?
Well, I think I'm always very interested in our relationship to our own bodies, and I think twins immediately makes you deal with that question. Most of us take our understanding of ourselves as individuals, as unique from what we are physically. We don't look exactly like anybody else. We don't sound exactly like anybody else. And that's where we begin when we think of the identity. But if you imagine, of course, that you had someone walking around with you most of the time who looked exactly like you, sounded like you, thought very much like you, and was someone whom other people confused for you often, it forces you then to look someplace else for what is the essence of identity. What is the real I? And that's one of the things that attracted me to the subject of twins in the first place. That's that kind of schism. You've got two bodies exactly the same.
Well, you're directing one actor in both of those roles, Jeremy Irons, and you had to figure out subtle physical and vocal differences.
Yes.
To cue the audience about which character was speaking at each time.
Yeah.
How did you work that out with Irons about the different vocal and physical qualities each character would take on?
Basically, I mean, at first, we weren't sure how far to go. That was really the scary part, was how different should we make them? How we didn't want to go too far. And we really sort of felt our way towards it. I mean, at one point, Jeremy asked if he could have two dressing rooms, one for each character. and he wasn't kidding, because it just in order to keep... He needed to keep them separate himself, because the film was shot in the normal filmic way, which is to say very much out of sequence.
Both of these gynecologists are in love with the same woman, an actress played by Genevieve Bugeaud. And through a gynecological exam, they find out that she has a deformed uterus. She has three cervixes. So one of the gynecologists, while he's having an emotional breakdown, creates this set of surgical instruments to work on women with deformed insides. And yes. I want to play a little clip about that. I should say that these surgical tools really look like tools of mutilation and torture. Let's hear the clip.
Seems to be some problem about surgical instruments. About holding them as evidence of a disturbed mind.
I tried to tell you, Ellie. You just don't know the kind of patients you've been getting lately. I don't know what's going on out there. Patients are getting strange. They look all right on the outside, but their insides, they're deformed. Well, I had to deal with it somehow. Radical technology was required. Is definitely required.
That's Jeremy Irons in both roles, both of those doctor roles. This is in a lot of ways a gynecological horror film.
yes, I think it's true. I mean, when I tried to get this movie set up at various studios, I was often asked, well, do they have to be gynecologists? Can't they be lawyers or something? And I said, well, if you think they could be lawyers, then you really don't understand what this movie is about. It does deal with the relationships between men and women and the power structures that exist in society between men and women.
Well, you get at something that I don't think many men think about, which is how uncomfortable, what a loss of control you experience, what a feeling of violation you experience when you're a woman getting an internal examination. And you have some pretty horrifying scenes related to that. And I was wondering what interested you as a man in that kind of gynecological horror.
Well, I think, when you're writing, you do have to become your characters for the moment that you're writing them. And whether they're men or women, whether they're old or whatever, you really have to be prepared to get into their skins. And that's really that's when I become an actor, is when I'm writing, actually. And that's when I have to psych myself in to whatever my characters might be feeling.
Well, speaking of becoming an actor, you acted the role of the gynecologist in The Fly.
That's right.
It was you who delivers the maggot baby during the abortion nightmare.
That's true.
Why did you cast yourself as the gynecologist?
Well, it was actually very pragmatic. I'm not really into homages to anybody, including myself, and I'm not really into the sort of Hitchcock put yourself in your own movie kind of thing. Well, we did have an actor, actually was one of the producers of the show. I had wanted to cast him as that doctor, and he really basically got cold feet at the last minute. He wasn't sure he could do it. He got very nervous, and I was the only one around.
Right, okay.
It's as simple as that. I have to say also that when Martin Scorsese met me, he told me later that he had been afraid to meet me because of my movies, which he liked very much, but he said scared him very much.
Uh-huh.
And he was terrified that I would be some strange, bizarre kind of person. This is the guy who made Taxi Driver, you understand. And he said to me, when I walked in, he said he was relieved to see that I was a guy who looked more or less like a Beverly Hills gynecologist. So I thought, well, Marty is very good at casting. If he thinks I could play that role, maybe I should do it. I have to say, though, for Dead Ringers, I needed an actor who was a lot better than I am, so I didn't think about it.
Right. My guest is screenwriter and film director David Cronenberg, and his new film is called Dead Ringers. Jeremy Irons plays the role of twin gynecologists. Cronenberg's other films include The Fly, Scanners, Videodrome, and The Dead Zone. Your films deal with, I think of your films almost as parables about disease and about the mind-body split, about contagion. And some of these issues are things that people write, philosophy books about, that the great philosophers sit and talk about. You've chosen the horror genre for most of your movies, but you're really dealing with pretty serious issues, and you're dealing with them frequently in a very, very ironically funny way. And I wonder why you've chosen the horror genre to take on matters of real consequence.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's a sort of a perverse element in any artist. You don't want to. I mean, you wouldn't become an artist of any kind if you were worried about being in the mainstream. You already are a bit of an outsider if you choose to that profession, or if in fact that chooses you. So, it just seemed. I mean, it was very natural for me to start writing horror films because I like the kind of inventing that you could do. It's understood that you're not dealing with what most people think of as documentary reality when you do a horror film. So you're free to invent your own science, invent your own creatures, invent your own universe, really. And I enjoyed that. It was very exciting. Also, you are immediately plugging into, as you've pointed out, some very heavy stuff. I mean, you are talking, the true subject of all horror films, is as far as I'm concerned, is death.
Uh-huh.
And you are dealing with death, you're dealing with aging, separation, the question of is there an afterlife or not. It's fairly heavy, and it's very direct. There's no fooling around with a horror film. It's really, so those combinations of things, I think, are what really attract me to the genre. And I think, although Dead Ringers, I guess I wouldn't technically call a horror film. It's not like The Fly in the sense that there's not a lot of rubber, you know, not a lot of special effects. Still, I would agree that the tone of it is horrific, and the themes do connect with everything else I've done. It just seems very. I draw a lot of strength and power and energy from the genre itself.
Well, you get to some really interesting themes in your remake of The Fly, and it's about a scientist who does an experiment, but in the experiment he splices his genes with those of a fly, and he slowly starts transforming into a fly, and he sees his transformation as a cancer-like disease that he has no control over. I want to play a clip from this, and this is Jeff Goldblum as the scientist turning into a fly, and Gina Davis as his lover.
I seem to be stricken by a disease with a purpose, wouldn't you say? Maybe not such a bad disease after all.
I can't stay.
No. Why not? Why can't you?
I can't take it. It's too much.
That's what it takes. The disease has just revealed its purpose. We don't have to worry about contagion anymore. I know what the disease wants.
What does the disease want?
It wants to turn me into something else. That's not too terrible, is it? Most people would give anything to be turned into something else.
Turned into what?
What do you think, a fly? By becoming a 185-pound fly? No, I'm becoming something that never existed before. I'm becoming Brundlefly. Don't you think that's worth a Nobel Prize or two?
You get so much into that movie. Part of what's in that scene is seeing someone who you really love being totally transformed by this, ravaged by this uncontrollable disease, and it disgusts you, but you love the person, and do you leave because it disgusts you, or do you stay? How do you deal with it?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, although the premise is very sci-fi, the emotional reality of it, I think, is lived every day by many, many people around the world. I mean, for me, in a sense, the movie was really about aging at its most basic. The idea that every love affair is a tragic love affair because of the inevitability of death and separation. So that's really where that movie draws a lot of its emotional power from.
It's also a horror film about looking in the mirror, thinking like, oh, I look like that. That's disgusting. There's one scene where when Jeff Goldblum is turning into the fly, he's looking at the mirror, just absolutely disgusted with what he sees. He throws his razor against the wall, and then he picks up his hand, and he starts picking at his fingernails, and they just come off.
Yeah.
He just peels his fingernails off.
Yes.
And I don't know about you. I've had a lot of dreams like that. Do your fingernails ever come off in your dreams?
No, not in my dreams, but I do. I mean, I'm aware that most debilitating diseases begin with something relatively minor and small, but somehow very potently significant. A lot of people found that scene the hardest scene to take in the movie, and it was very minor in terms of special effects. He was actually biting his nails the way people do when they're nervous, and it comes off in his mouth. It's scary, and it's a portent of things to come, of course, and what it really suggests is how fragile we are, how fragile what we are in terms of the integrity of our bodies and our person. You know, we sometimes feel very invulnerable. Those are very nice moments, but just the slightest thing that's off, and you know that everything can come apart on you.
Have you ever been struck with a serious illness where you had to face the kind of debilitation that you describe in The Fly?
Not yet.
Well, I'm glad.
Me too. Very glad.
I actually was reading an article where your sister was quoted as saying that she thought that movie was influenced a lot by you and she having to watch your parents die very slowly of debilitating illnesses.
Well, I think she's wrong, really, about that, in the sense that I've been making movies that dealt with that subject when my parents were very healthy.
Uh-huh.
I think that's really more her own emotional projection than mine. But I think, you know, you don't have to actually have it happen to you to have empathy for it, you know?
You know what I love, though? You're able to take these really heavy, morbid subjects and inject this great humor in it, like when Jeff Goldblum in The Fly says, "I won't be just another tumorous bore."
Yes. Well, and it's the same in Dead Ringers. I mean, I don't think I could make a movie without some humor, because one of the wonderful things about the way humans deal with the universe as it's given to them is through humor. I mean, that's a way that you can diffuse things or gain some control over them. And when my characters are in trouble, they tend to get very funny.
Good. I want to talk with you more about your movies, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is screenwriter and film director David Cronenberg. His new film, Dead Ringers, stars Jeremy Irons in two roles. He plays twin gynecologists whose almost psychic closeness leads to their undoing. Cronenberg's earlier films include the remake of The Fly, Scanners, Videodrome, and The Dead Zone. He's joining us from the NPR Bureau in Chicago. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Speaking with screenwriter and film director David Cronenberg, whose new film is Dead Ringers. Let's go back a few years to one of your earlier films, Scanners. And I think
Sure.
this was your first film to actually really get some commercial play in the United States.
Yeah, it actually was the number one film the weekend that it opened, which was quite a surprise since it was a very relatively low-budget picture that was coming from a small distributor.
The film is about baby boomers who are now in their mid-30s. And they were born telepathic because of an experimental drug administered to their mothers during pregnancy. But the telepathy becomes an affliction because they can't control it and they can't turn it off. So when they walk by people, they're always reading their minds, and their own minds are just invaded by the voices of others. How did you come up with that? It just seems to me like the perfect metaphor for those of us who feel totally overwhelmed and inundated by information.
Sure. Sure, and even as you say that, I realize that one of the themes of Scanners was also identity. You know, how can you find your own mind when you have so many other minds speaking in your head? And that does connect very directly to sort of the themes of Dead Ringers. It's very difficult for me to say where these things come from. It feels very tangible to me, but when I sit down and start to write, I have no idea what's going to come up out of the typewriter. It's very mysterious, you know. Sometimes a film will start for me with an image, a dream, a line of dialogue, a character. It can come from anywhere.
Was there an image or a dream that kicked off Scanners?
I really can't remember how that started.
Okay.
I really can't.
There's a scene where one of the people who is telepathic and can't get the voices out of his head explains why he drilled a hole in his head to
Yes.
let out the voices. And I'll tell you, whenever I have a really bad headache, I think of that scene.
Well, I remember in the 60s there were a couple of instances of people who did drill holes in their forehead. It had more to do with the idea of the third eye and so on, but they all did seem to speak of it as a relief of pressure, and they weren't speaking of physical pressure. I think they were speaking of psychic pressure, and as you mentioned that, it recurs to me that when people ask me about what the process of showing one of my films is to me, I realize now that I often speak of it as though a hole were drilled in someone's forehead so that their dreams could be projected directly onto a screen and with people watching. And I've actually never made that connection before, but of course it does connect very directly with that image in Scanners.
It's a great image. There's a scene where an artist is tracked down, who's one of these telepathic guys, and he makes sculptures of giant heads, which is the perfect art for someone
right.
who's lost in their head to be making. I want to play a clip from that scene. One scanner who can't control his voices has tracked down this artist. Here we go.
It's the voices in my head. They're driving me crazy.
How do you stop them? Your voices.
My art. My art keeps me sane.
What a great scene. You could tell that artist isn't particularly sane at all.
That's right. It isn't working, is it?
Well, does your art keep you sane?
Well, I don't know, because I haven't been without it for a long time, but I have a feeling that it's a very necessary part of my nervous system to be able to do what I do. I don't think of it in very psychotherapeutic terms. I think, you know, the idea of psychoanalyzing artists and art is, I think, really begs the question of what art is and what the purpose of it is. But at the same time, I suppose it's like being a great athlete and never getting to run or play basketball or whatever it is that you do. It's certainly going to be frustrating and certainly make you feel that something that you were meant to do is not being allowed to be done.
But I wonder if it keeps you sane or drives you crazy to always be making movies about the things that disturb you the most.
Oh, it doesn't drive me crazy at all. I think it is very, it makes me feel actually that I'm coming to terms with it somehow, that I'm, you know, I mean, one of the reasons that people create is to give them the illusion that they have control over their lives and maybe other people's lives, you know. You can go back to your little garret and start writing novels with thousands of characters and you're controlling them all, you know. Now, you know, at the same time, it's an illusion, but it's somehow comforting to think that you can do that.
Speaking with screenwriter and film director David Cronenberg, one of the things that you're well known for is the special effects in your movies and scanners. When someone's brain is being scanned, when they're being telepathically picked, their head can explode from the pressure of it. And there's in one of the opening scenes, some guy's head just explodes over the room. So I should ask you how you pulled that off in the film.
That particular one was pretty interesting because we tried to be very sophisticated. Of course, we were, part of the trick, of course, is in the editing. Yeah. But in terms of the actual head, we had several heads made that were very elaborate. They really had skulls and skin and brains and things. But when we tried to explode them by putting a charge inside the head, the fluids there would just vaporize and you'd get steam and you couldn't see anything. We eventually just blew the head with a shotgun.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the special effects guy was lying on the floor behind the chair, and he just used a shotgun to explode the head.
Yeah, but wasn't there a real person underneath the fake head?
No, God, no.
Oh, good. I should hope not. Otherwise, it would be like William Tell or something.
No, that actor has gone on to be very successful in Canada with his own TV series. He wouldn't have been if he had been under that head, I can assure you. The thing that drives me crazy, just as an aside, is that often a photo purporting to be the photo of on set of that head exploding is printed. In fact, in the magazine I think that you were referring to before, they do print a photo. It's a sort of a stuntman with a kind of sparkler on his head. No one has ever actually printed a photo of the real head from the movie, and it's actually a fantastic shot. It's one of those shots that just by some miracle works out perfectly every frame. It's very surreal. I mean, it really looks like a Dali painting or something, frame by frame, because his face sort of unfolds. It still has a startled expression on it, even as it's coming apart. It's really quite phenomenal.
Well, if I remember correctly, that part of the scene is cut out when it's shown on television in the United States.
Well, it depends. I mean, certainly on pay TV, you see the movie, if it's ever shown on pay TV, I don't know. But yeah, I was required to shoot a TV version in which that character has a heart attack instead of having his head blown up. But in a way, that's really more grotesque and awful because you really get to watch this guy as he suffers. And I find that that's always the way it works with censorship. People who try to control what you do end up having exactly the opposite effect. They make things much, much worse.
Is censorship a subject you've been forced to give a lot of thought to?
Yes, because in Canada we still have forms of censorship that would be quite illegal and unconstitutional in the U.S. And I have had the misfortune to be to have a film, The Brood, censored by the Ontario Censor Board. And this is a group of people who sit in a back room, look at your movies, and cut them physically. I mean, they actually physically cut every print themselves and keep the little pieces. And if you want the film to be shown in Ontario, and usually that means the rest of Canada, you have to submit to this. You have nothing to say about it. You don't have the choice of withdrawing it as you do here. It's very totalitarian, and it's something, an aspect of Canadian life that I really despise, and I've been working with various groups against it for years and years.
Well, you are a Canadian filmmaker, and Canada is always so anxious to have Canadian artists represented to the world, but I wonder if they think that you're not what they had in mind.
Well, certainly, I mean, another Marty Scorsese story. I mean, in the early days when he was apparently trying to get in touch with me, of course, I was delighted later when I heard that he actually liked my films because I admired him so much. But he came to Toronto in the early days of the Toronto Film Festival, and they said to him, well, Mr. Scorsese, is there any Canadian filmmaker that you'd like to meet? And he said, yeah, there's this guy David Cronenberg. And they kind of hemmed and hawed and said, well, he's not really in town very much. Sure, there's nobody else you'd rather meet? And he never got to meet me that time around. Since then, it's gone quite the opposite direction. I can tell Dead Ringers was the gala presentation which opened the Toronto Film Festival.
Oh.
There were speeches by the Minister of Culture about how wonderful I was. And that's almost more scary, you know, because I think you don't want to get too well-liked and you don't want to get too establishment. I mean, you really don't want to lose the edge to your work and start to worry about how lovable you are. And, you know, I think it's a balance, you know. You need to be an outsider. You need to remain outside up to a certain point anyway. Things have definitely changed in Canada, though. There's no question about that.
I just have one last question for you. Some of your early films had to do with contagion, fear of catching disease, of catching germs or parasites or little mm-hmm. monsters. Are you especially afraid of that yourself?
No, it's interesting. I mean, Shivers, which in the States was called They Came Within, From Within, has been called the sort of the first sort of prophetic AIDS movie, because it is in fact about a very virulent venereal disease that spreads rapidly. But in fact, in those movies, I'm almost doing that sort of writing acting trick again. I'm saying, what is it like to be a disease? I mean, I'm trying to play the role of the disease. After all, a virus that invades your body is just doing what it's designed to do. I mean, it's fulfilling its own destiny by destroying you. I'm really trying to come to terms with the way nature works and the way the world works. I'm not really particularly a disease paranoid at all.
I never thought of the viruses as having found an ally in you.
Well, I try to understand it, you know. There's a little sign, a couple of signs on the wall in Shivers, and it came from within, which says that sex was the invention of a clever venereal disease. That was the line. If you try to see sex from the point of view of the AIDS virus, it's a strange little mental twist to do, but it can be done.
Well, I regret that we're out of time. I thank you so very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
David Cronenberg's latest film, Dead Ringers, has just come out on home video. It stars Jeremy Irons in the roles of twin gynecologists. Cronenberg's other movies include Scanners, The Fly, The Dead Zone, and Videodrome. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air. Next time, our guest will be writer Bebe Moore Campbell. Her new memoir, Sweet Summer, tells of how her parents' divorce opened up two worlds to her, the world of advice, culture, and Christianity with her mother and grandmother in Philadelphia, and the world of baseball games on TV and beer in the refrigerator with her father during the summers in the South. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we follow actress Pamela Reed's career from the Old West to the Midwest. Reed played a dancehall girl in the movie The Long Riders and the campaign manager in HBO's political spoof Tanner 88. Now she stars in Rachel River as a single mother in a small town in northern Minnesota. It will be broadcast next week on public television. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Valis. It's a new opera based on science fiction writer Philip K. Dick's semi-autobiographical novel. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg is back with his annual Flag Day attempt to decipher the lyrics of our national anthem. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The House failed today to override President Bush's veto of a $4.55 an hour minimum wage plan. The vote of 247 to 178 was short of the two-thirds necessary to overturn Bush's rejection of the legislation. Democrats immediately began working toward a compromise to boost the pay rate, the base pay rate that has not changed since 1981. House Democrats today rounded out their leadership team, electing Richard Gephardt, majority leader, and William Gray, party whip. The special elections were forced by the resignations of Speaker Jim Wright and Whip Tony Coelho, both following ethics allegations. Tom Foley of Washington was elected Speaker last week. The Bush administration today lodged a vigorous protest with the Chinese government over the expulsion of two U.S. journalists from China. More from NPR's Jim Angle.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the administration joins news organizations in viewing this matter with great concern. Fitzwater said the Chinese accused the two American journalists of distorting facts, spreading rumors, and instigating turmoil. On the contrary, he said, we believe these journalists were trying to report the truth of the situation in China. Harassing journalists trying to do their jobs and jamming VOA broadcasts, said Fitzwater, will not succeed in keeping the truth about what is going on in China from being heard, either there or throughout the world. When journalists are expelled from the Soviet Union, the U.S. customarily retaliates by expelling an equal number of Soviet reporters. But today, the State Department discouraged the idea the U.S. would retaliate in this case. The White House, however, said the State Department was looking at a number of options. I'm Jim Angle at the White House.
One day after the Chinese media broadcast names and pictures of 21 pro-democracy student leaders, two are reported to be under arrest. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Chinese authorities have been turning up the volume on propaganda and threats, and the tactics seem to be paying off. State-run media report that two of the country's most wanted student leaders have been turned in, one by his own relatives. For the past several days, the media have been encouraging the public to inform on the students and warning of dire consequences for harboring fugitives. The 21 students were some of the top leaders of China's pro-democracy movement and the hunger strike in Tiananmen Square. Chinese authorities still are trying to gain custody of one of the country's most well-known dissidents. Fang Lijie and his wife were granted refuge by the U.S. Embassy. The embassy has rejected China's demands that the two be surrendered to Chinese authorities. In Beijing, this is Vicky O'Hara.
Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev was given a tumultuous welcome as he arrived in one of West Germany's most technologically advanced states today. Gorbachev went to Stuttgart to meet with industrial leaders and view the high-tech robotics he needs to modernize the Soviet economy. Gorbachev is calling for closer integration of the Soviet and West German economies and has challenged German businessmen to invest in large Soviet projects rather than what he called trifles. Israeli warplanes attacked Palestinian bases outside Beirut today, killing at least three guerrillas and wounding 10 more. Six warplanes flew two bombing runs on the base near Syrian army positions. The Israeli military command says the attack was aimed at one of three Palestinian groups harbored at the base. President Bush today urged congressional leaders to strip special interest amendments from the Savings and Loan Rescue Bill and make the thrifts inject real capital into the bailout. The $157 billion rescue plan is currently under debate in the House. Stock prices were mixed today in moderate trading on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped less than a point to close at 2503.36. Advances slightly outnumbered declines on volume of 172 million shares. You're listening to NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a recording of a new opera called Valis by electronic music composer Todd Machover. Valis was commissioned for the 10th anniversary of the Pompidou Center in Paris and had its world premiere there in December of 1987. This Friday, Valis has its American stage premiere at MIT's experimental media facility known as The Cage.
That elegantly synthesized crash marks the opening of Todd Machover's Valis. It's an electronic opera based on the semi-autobiographical novel by the late science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. Dick's best-known work, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, became the movie Blade Runner. Dick wrote Valis in 1981. A year later, he died at the age of 56. The opera's two main characters are Philip K. Dick and his alter ego, Horse Lover Fat, which is a literal translation of Philip, Greek for lover of horses, and Dick, German for thick or fat. The same baritone sings both parts, both live and pre-taped. Fat is out of touch with his life. He has failed to save his friend Gloria from suicide. He told her it would make him feel bad. Phil says Fat couldn't have given her a worse reason for staying alive. Then Fat has a nervous breakdown. He experiences a blinding pink flash, and for most of the opera, he tries to discover what it means to reintegrate his divided self. Here's the first of his duets. The singer is Patrick Mason.
How many worlds do we exist in simultaneously?
Valis is an acronym for Vast Active Living Intelligent System, the apparent source of Fat's psychic lightning bolt. The second half of the opera is a kind of phantasmagoria. There's a rock singing couple and a computer music composer named Mini, as in minimalist. He's described in the libretto as crippled and wild-looking and is performed by Valis's composer, Todd Machover. There's a mysterious figure named Sophia, who may be only a hologram. Each offers Fat, or is it Phil, the ambiguous consolations of Valis as he begins his psycho-spiritual recovery. Soprano Anna Zema is the perfect embodiment of the angelic Sophia.
I'm not afraid, my search is over.
The technical complexity of Valis is nothing if not state-of-the-art, with its many layers of electronic manipulations. Banks of computers, synthesizers, and tape decks transform the sounds of real singers, a real piano, and a real percussion section. Much of the music is remarkably haunting. References to Wagner's Parsifal, which also has a hero searching for truth and a magical transformation scene, mingle with shades of rock, medieval music, and minimalism. But rhythmically, Valis gets a little monotonous and the jokes heavy-handed. Some of the prettiness is just syrupy. For all its complexity, the opera seems sentimental. When Phil says, quietly, "Love proceeds from the true God, which is myself," it's hard to feel any irony. When the voice of the dead Gloria, sung by Janis Felty, comes back in a dream to reassure Phil, the saccharine blend of soft rock and country music isn't convincing enough to be what Phil calls the most beautiful song I ever heard. Whatever its problems, though, Vallis is still an intriguing and ambitious venture. And in a dazzling production, the combination of theatrical and oral wizardry might dissolve anyone's critical armor.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a recording of Todd Machover's opera Vallis on the Bridge label. Vallis has its American premiere this Friday night at MIT in Cambridge.
The universe is information.
This is Fresh Air. One of last year's more innovative cable TV series was Tanner 88, a satire of the American presidential campaign written by Gary Trudeau and directed by Robert Altman. Pamela Reed played Tanner's tough, chain-smoking campaign manager. Reed's versatility as an actress can be measured by the role she's had. She played a Mormon in Melvin and Howard and the dance hall girl Belle Starr in The Long Riders. Her latest film is Rachel River, which will air nationally June 21st on the PBS series American Playhouse. Reed stars as a single mother, barely making ends meet as a radio journalist in a northern Minnesota town. Though Reed has been living in New York for over 10 years now, she says there were things about the story of this small town that she could identify with.
I think that a lot of people feel that the time that they have on this planet is spent in solitary confinement, that they seem to be going through a routine but really not getting anywhere, or that the town they lived in has had its day, you know, and they want to reinvest in that area and make it better and make it their town. And I think that she feels that way, the character that I played. You know, she sort of felt lost, and it wasn't about moving away and going to Chicago or something. It was about making her life better in this town and making this town better because she was living a better life.
Mm-hmm. Did you spend any time in the Midwest in small towns before performing in the movie to get a sense of what life was like there and what the people were like?
Oh, yeah, well, I didn't grow up in New York. I grew up in Tacoma, Washington. I also grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland. But Tacoma is very much, certain parts of Tacoma are very much like this area. So I didn't feel like a foreigner there at all.
This character strikes me as being really different from a character you played in an earlier movie, The Long Riders, in which you played Belle Starr, the dance hall whore. And, this was a one who's really tough and really hardened. How did you prepare for that role?
You know, sometimes you work opposite really good actors, and all you have to do is react. And the actors in The Long Riders were of that caliber. And David Carradine was just so, he made it so easy when I worked off of him.
He played Cole Younger.
Yeah, exactly. And rhythmically and musically, in terms of the cadence of the lines, it was so easy to point, counterpoint him.
There's a gesture that I think was really very telling, and I'd like to know whether this was in the script or whether it was something that you just came up with. There's a scene where Bell Starr is naked in the tub in an upstairs room in the bar, and David Carradine, as Cole Younger, comes up the stairs and just kind of walks right in. He's looking for her, and she does this whole, well, here I am, and she's naked in the tub and just kind of sits up and opens up her arms and maybe her legs in this whole gesture of display. It's just the opposite of shyness. And I thought it was just the perfect gesture there. What's the story behind the gesture?
Well, I turned the film down 3 times because of this scene. I didn't want to do nudity. I had a big, big, big talk with my father about this. This was before my father died. And I said, you know, I just don't want to do this. And we talked, and he said, well, then fine, don't. But we talked through the film, and I told him, you know, what was going on. And it was a series of bathtub scenes in the whorehouse that they didn't want to cut out. And it was, my father said, this isn't out of context, and people don't take baths with their clothes on, and the director has promised you that he will protect you. Well, when that day came around, my father had died, and David took me for a long walk on the lot, and he showed me a place where he used to live on the lot, and he told me about his life, and then they came and got us and said, you know, it's time to, you know, get undressed for the scene. And I came in, and they built a box set, so which meant that just who had to be there was there, just the camera crew, actually. And I got in, and I'd asked for a girl, one of the extras who I'd become friends with, to be there with me. And she was, and sat in the tub, and the water was cold. And David had to come in the door and burst through the door, and I had to grab my gun and say, most people knock, you know. And he just stopped, and he just looked at me, and he looked at me from my nose to my toes, and nobody did anything. And when he got to my face, I felt like Simone Signoret in her prime. I felt so beautiful. I knew I'd done the right thing, and it was at that moment that I fell in love with film, and the absolute freedom that is allotted to you in that art form. I didn't feel exploited one bit. I felt beautiful. And it was true, when I saw the movie, I looked a little better than I do in real life. And and they just showed my back. I mean, it was fine. But it was a real turning point for me that day.
Wow. Yeah, you know, that scene, as I was describing it, like as you're revealing your body, you're revealing it to Cole Younger, to David Carradine, but not to the audience, because your body isn't really frontally on camera at all.
No, it's just about what happens in that room.
Yeah.
And it's not the kind of thing where you've got bodies all over the place for the audience to get some kind of vicarious thrill out of. It's not about that.
Would you still have the same hesitation if you were asked to do a nude scene now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would, yeah. Because a lot of nude scenes that women are asked to do are completely
exploitational.
Gratuitous.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's silly, you know. So there has to be a reason for it.
Mm-hmm. What's your assessment of the kinds of roles you see written for women of your age in the movies?
Well, I get confused sometimes by a conservative ethic that's really been predominant in this country, certainly for the last 8 years. I'd like to see someone be a winner without joining the conservative ranks, you know, that the idea of success isn't necessarily holding up a big diamond ring at the end of the movie or getting a 3-piece suit and being accepted by the boys. That's something that bothers me. On the other hand, I think that we're seeing a lot more women in roles that reflect responsibility and their passion and their intelligence and their independence, and I like that. So it's a mixed bag.
Do you think that you're offered particular kinds of roles? I always like to find out about actors, how they think they're cast based on their looks.
Well, with women, it's a problem because somehow men get older. I know actors that I've played opposite who probably won't play opposite me now because they want to play opposite younger and younger women. And a lot of my girlfriends in their 30s who are actresses do discuss that, you know, and that a man wants to be seen with a woman who's 22 rather than 32. It's just a fact, and I'm not saying that all male actors are like that, but there are enough out there.
Do you have other roles coming up in the near future that we'd be interested in hearing about?
Oh, I just, I did a film that's being edited now called Chattahoochee, and it stars Gary Oldman and Dennis Hopper. It's a great cast, Fran McDormand, Ned Beatty, a lot of really good people.
It must be really neat to work with such a good cast.
Oh, man, you know it.
Have you ever worked with an actor, I don't know, like maybe Gary Oldman or Dennis Hopper, whose technique was really different than yours and you had to realign yourself so that you could be on the same plane with them because their acting style was so different?
No. I guess maybe I've run into an actor or two where it was all about style, and then that's always tough because it shouldn't be about style. Technique is something that you leave. You know, you can stand at the bar and do all of your exercises before you go up on point and walk out on stage. But once you're out on stage, you're on point and you're doing it. It's mm-hmm. no time to do your bar work.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Pamela Reed stars in the film Rachel River. You can see it June 21st on Public Television's American Playhouse series. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. On our program tonight, a discussion of the Chinese economy, fears being expressed about foreign investment leaving that country, or the lack of new investor confidence. Tourism in China is now understandably almost at a standstill. Also, my colleague Robert Siegel reports from Bonn on prospects for increased cooperation between East and West Germany. And this question, should former President Ronald Reagan accept an honorary knighthood from Britain? And quotations, false quotations to be exact, from the book They Never Said It. These quotations, don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes and blood, sweat, and tears.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today we continue an annual Fresh Air Flag Day tradition, having our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg untangle the national anthem and the Pledge of Allegiance.
People have been complaining for years that the Star-Spangled Banner is impossible for the merely human among us to sing. What's interesting is that you never hear complaints about what should be an even more serious deficiency of the song, which is that nobody can understand what it says. By way of example, listen closely and be prepared to answer a listening comprehension question when I finish. Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous night o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming? Now then, what is the object of the verb watch? That is, what exactly was it that Francis Scott Key was watching? The broad stripes and bright stars? The flag? Listen again. This time I'll try to simplify the wording and untangle some of the syntax. Oh, say, can you see by the light of dawn what we hailed so proudly at the gleam of twilight, whose stripes and stars were streaming gallantly through the night over the ramparts we watched? That's right. What Key and his companion were watching was not the flag, but the ramparts, the fortified embankments around Fort McHenry. Oh, they saw the flag, all right, but that's not what the song says. Now, you can write the song out and check it at your leisure. The point is that if you're like most people, you've never really thought about any of this before. But then, why should you have? After all, we learned these words when we were about 7 or 8, and children of that age could scarcely understand them. Over and above the stilted syntax, how many kids know what a rampart is? For that matter, how often does an adult civilian have occasion to talk about ramparts in the normal course of daily life? But why have we picked on an anthem that's so obviously incomprehensible, and how come nobody seems to mind? It's not just that the Star-Spangled Banner is an embarrassingly bad poem, if you actually stop to think about it. The fact is that we generally prefer for our patriotic ditties and oaths to be obscure. I was struck by this a year or so ago when I was helping my French-born wife prepare for her citizenship test. Her immigration lawyer told her to prepare for two items that were absolutely sure to appear on the exam. She should be ready to define a pocket veto and to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. It was the second of these she had trouble with. Oh, she learned the words all right, but she recited it funny. She said, "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands." I explained to her that she'd got it all wrong. Real Americans say it as if it were four long words. "I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands." Now, you couldn't do better than this if you deliberately set out to write an oath that children would find utterly incomprehensible. I suppose that most of us wondered idly about it when we were kids. What does this word pledge allegiance mean, and who's this guy Richard Stans? It's interesting that people should get so head up about whether the words under God should be in there or not, and yet be wholly indifferent to the fact that kids can't make heads or tails of the pledge in the first place. The fact is that our pledge and our national anthem are exactly as we want them to be. We don't really want people to ponder these words too deeply, no more than we want people to reflect too deeply about their love of country. As an Italian friend of mine once remarked, America is the only country whose citizens are patriotic without being nationalistic. And when you come to think about it, most of the really good anthems do seem to belong to countries with strong nationalistic traditions. God Save the Queen, La Marseillaise, Deutschland über alles, even Dixie, I suppose. Now, those are anthems with a sort of stirring words and rousing tunes that you can sing with nationalist fervor. For example, when you want to drown somebody else's anthem out. Well, but that sort of thing isn't really for us. What we want is a song we can mutter inattentively from the bleachers.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Tim Wilson will sit in for me, and he'll speak with the Dean of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City, James Park Morton. Morton's come up with some unique ways to make his Gothic cathedral a center of the modern community. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review three new examples of glasnost rock, and film critic Stephen Schiff will review Ghostbusters 2, so hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. NPR, National Public Radio.